From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the Ring of Fire Studios in Pensacola, Florida. I'd like to thank Mike Papantonio for welcoming us once again and Scott Milliken for his expert work on this edition of State of Belief. This program, as you know, is made possible in part by the generous support of you, listeners just like you. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, August 29th marks the Hindu observance of Raksha Bandhan, a celebration of sibling love. Tuesday marks the beginning of the Orthodox Christian ecclesiastical year, and on Saturday the 5th, Hindus will celebrate Krishna Jayanti, the birth of Krishna. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
Slovakia has said that it will help with Europe's migrant crisis, but it will only take in Christians.
No Muslims need apply, nor for that matter anyone who isn't Christian. As offensive as that statement is, imagine it being applied to desperate refugees fleeing the destruction of war. But that's exactly the message several European nations have sent as the region struggles with record-breaking numbers of refugees fleeing Syrian and other conflicts. We'll look at the implications of this Christians-only message with Catherine Orsborn, director of the Shoulder to Shoulder campaign.
Governor Asa Hutchinson signing a bill today allowing a monument of the Ten Commandments to be placed at the state capitol.
The new law states putting up the monument will not mean the state of Arkansas favors any particular religion over others.
We've talked a lot on this show about the various American states that display monuments to the Ten Commandments on state capitol grounds. Among the legal challenges to these monuments, perhaps the one that made the most headlines, was a request from self-proclaimed Satanists in Oklahoma. But in Arkansas, an interfaith campaign is building in support of a plan to add a monument to the Hindu lord Hanuman, known for his strength and correct grammar, on the Capitol grounds, where a law requiring a Ten Commandments monument was passed earlier this year. We'll explore this story with Suhag Shukla, Executive Director of the Hindu American Foundation. But first,
flawed and distorted. That is what one group is calling some new textbooks from which Texas children could soon be studying.
As kids across our nation head back to school, some states are rolling out curricula that can serve as textbook examples of revisionist agendas. We can always count on Texas to be at the forefront of such initiatives. And as we've pointed out before on this show, the impact is magnified because some smaller states tend to adopt the teaching materials used in the nation's second most populous state. For a look at this, as well as attempts to funnel public dollars to private Christian schools in Texas, I'm now joined by Dan Quinn, Communications Director at the Texas Freedom Network. Dan, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I want to start with you giving us an update of where things stand for this school year.
Well, the textbooks that the State Board of Education adopted last year in history and social studies, actually they went into classrooms this week. Those textbooks are based on very controversial curriculum standards the State Board adopted in 2009 and 2010. Those standards were heavily politicized. Even conservative outfits like the Fordham Institute criticized them as a politicized distortion of history. They downplayed the role that slavery played in causing the Civil War. They didn't even mention things like Jim Crow laws or the Black Codes after the Civil War. They suggested that Moses was a major influence on the writing of the American Constitution, that the roots of democracy can be found in the Old Testament. It was essentially just sort of a long diatribe, a long screed of religious right arguments that we've heard over and over again in the political realm, now pushed into classrooms. So the publishers had to deal with these standards. They submitted their new textbooks last year. The good news is they did a much better job than the standards in a lot of places. Slavery is clearly the cause of the Civil War. They discuss black codes. They talk about Jim Crow, the Ku Klux Klan, all of which are left out of the standards. But there are some areas where they do fall a little short. In some cases, publishers did feel compelled to provide some of the arguments that states' rights was the cause of the Civil War. Scholars have said over and over again, states' rights was not the reason the war was fought. It was simply slavery. If it was any right at all, it was the right to enslave other human beings, if that's what states were fighting for. But even worse, I think, is the publishers completely caved to the state board's demands that they exaggerate the influences of religion in American history. Mm. Now, don't get me wrong here. Religion had a profound influence on our country, largely for good, unfortunately sometimes for ill, but it would be bad history not to teach students about the importance of religion in our history. But textbooks and the State Board of Education don't have to make things up, and that's kind of what they did here. Yeah. I mean, they clearly say that Moses was a major influence on the founders in writing the Constitution. Scholars that we showed this to who reviewed the textbook said this was just absolutely absurd. One of the passages in one of the textbooks just very clearly says the roots of democracy can be found in the Old Testament, in Old Testament stories about figures like King Solomon. That's just complete, total nonsense.
Hey, how did Jefferson fare this time?
Jefferson's in there, believe it or not. He, you know, there were, as you recall, efforts by some board members to remove him from a list of important political thinkers in the world history curriculum standards. Big controversy over that. Of course, the religious writers who wanted to strike him out, I assume, just didn't like him because he coined the term separation of church and state. But they were so embarrassed by all the backlash that they had to put him back in. So he's definitely in the textbooks that are going into classrooms.
Then, if there's any doubt that a political agenda is driving this, all we have to do is look at the role that activists like David Barton are playing in it. Now, can you comment on that?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. When the board adopted their very politicized standards in 2009, guess who they appointed to a panel of so-called expert advisors? David Barton. And Barton went before them and talked about, you know, Moses being a major influence on our government today, that, you know, he wrote the first sort of set rules and laws for civilization, and the founders certainly knew about that, and that's what they were thinking about when they wrote the Constitution. He made a variety of arguments throughout. In fact, at one point even criticized the inclusion of Cesar Chavez in the standards because he accused him of being a socialist and a follower of radicals. So he wanted him removed entirely from the standards. Mm. And it's not just in Texas. We see him, he brags about being appointed as an advisor in states around the country when education officials begin to revise curriculum standards from state to state. So David Barton may have started in Texas, but the problem is metastasized far outside the Lone Star State.
Dan, some of our people may not know, who is David Barton?
So David Barton is the founder and head of an organization called Wall Builders, and essentially its mission is to convince people that the United States was founded as a distinctly Christian nation, that the founders intended our laws to be based on a fundamentalist reading of the Bible, and that separation of church and state is, quote, a myth. So this has been an organization he's run for quite some time now. But he was also listed in Time magazine some years back as one of the 25 most influential evangelicals in the country. I tend to call him the propaganda minister for the religious right. The Republican Party has hired him to go around the country and recruit pastors into the party. In the 2004 re-election campaign for George Bush, the RNC hired him to campaign for him with pastors around the country. He takes folks on tours of the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol, and provides his very distinct revisionist history of the country. In those gatherings, he's favored by folks like Newt Gingrich and Glenn Beck, who has him on his show quite often. Mm-hmm. He is a very influential and very savvy propaganda artist, but it doesn't take very long to find out that a lot of what he's telling you is just a rotten bill of goods.
Yeah. How does the kind of material being taught in Texas spread to other states?
Well, Texas is, of course, the second most populous state in the country. We adopt all of our textbooks here from K-12 at the state level. They go onto an approved list, and then schools typically buy from that list. So there's a huge, huge market here in Texas. Publishers write to the standards here so that they can sell a lot of books here, and then they do as little changing as they can to sell those books in other states around the country. So I like to say, unlike Vegas, what happens in Texas doesn't stay in Texas when it comes to textbooks. The problems that we have here, caused by the State Board of Education and the politicization of education here, they show up in states far outside of Texas, unfortunately.
Dan, there's a disturbing lawsuit that's been filed by the Houston Pastors Council. What are they up to?
Other folks have brought this lawsuit. It's challenging the way Texas funds its public schools and whether or not it meets the constitutional requirement for providing sufficient funding. Now this group, the Pastor Council, is arguing that unless any funding system for schools includes public funding for religious schools through vouchers or some other scheme, that's unconstitutional because it would be a violation of religious liberty, religious freedom, a discrimination against religious schools. So here we have it now. If tax dollars aren't funneled into sectarian schools, somehow that's a violation of religious freedom. That just sort of turns religious freedom on its head.
What is the process, or is there a process, for addressing these kinds of edits to history, and is there anything we can do about it?
Well, in Texas, of course, we adopt the standards, then the textbooks at the state level, and local school districts decide which books they're going to buy off, typically off that list, although they have a bit more flexibility now. I think the key thing for folks to keep in mind is, no matter where they live, I would go into your school and ask, did this textbook, did they sell this in Texas? And then if they say yes, I would go through that with a fine-tooth comb and make sure that the nonsense that we're teaching kids here in this state isn't making it into states around the country. The other thing is they need to make their voices heard whenever textbooks are adopted at the state level in their own states. You know, the South is generally the states you'll see textbook adoptions at the state level. Up north, typically a lot of those adoptions are made entirely at the local level. So they'll have to go into the local school boards, find out, when are we adopting new textbooks? Mm-hmm. You know, what are kids supposed to learn in this classroom? What we've learned over the years is, and it's the old adage, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. Mm-hmm. And the religious right, particularly in Texas, has been the loudest complainer, the loudest manipulator of education for a long time now. Because I think a lot of mainstream folks have just sort of sat back and said, well, I'm sure things are going fine. The teachers will handle this. But essentially what bodies like the State Board of Education are doing is they're throwing those teachers under the bus. They're giving them these terribly politicized standards and very often politicized textbooks, and then they say, you figure out how to do this the right way and teach real history. And that's really a disservice both to teachers and to the students.
Interfaith Alliance has always been happy to cooperate with you. What's on your plate right now? Where's the central focus for the Texas Freedom Network as we talk?
Well, there are a couple of big things that we're working on. One is supporting the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance. We're putting a lot of effort into that and also trying to turn back efforts to overturn similar measures that, you know, protect against discrimination in other cities around the state. And we've also been focusing a lot of work on reproductive justice. There have been efforts at the state level, largely successful, to limit women's access to reproductive health care in the state, including abortion care, but also contraception. Low-income women have found it increasingly difficult to find access to reproductive health care in the state. So those are two big areas that we're working on quite a bit lately.
Dan Quinn is Communications Director at the Texas Freedom Network, which is celebrating 20 years of protecting religious freedom, defending civil liberties, and strengthening public schools. Dan, thanks a lot for being with us today on State of Belief.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and we love working with the Interfaith Alliance, so y'all take care.
The heartbreaking plight of refugees fleeing violence and war is a global concern. Even as many nations look for ways to help, there's also the question of how to handle large influxes of desperate people. Here in the United States, the issue is highly politicized, with rhetoric about the southern border guaranteed to score points with some constituencies. In Europe, the unprecedented number of refugees from Syria and other war-torn nations has inspired the same fears and arguments. Now, an additional layer has been added to the debate as Poland, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic say they'll meet their European Union-mandated responsibility to take in some refugees as long as those refugees are Christian. Catherine Osborne is director of the Shoulder to Shoulder campaign, an interfaith coalition working to end anti-Muslim sentiment, of which Interfaith Alliance is a proud member. Catherine, thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
You know, I can't help but think that while anti-Islamic bias in any forum is bad enough, it's even worse when you're talking about the helpless victims of war and violence. That's why this story is especially disturbing. The nations in question are pleading assimilation, as in because most of their populations are non-Muslim, the refugees would not, quote, unquote, feel comfortable there. While that may play well in terms of domestic politics, what does it portend for the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Syria and elsewhere?
Well, there are over 4 million people in crisis, basically refugees, registered right now with the UNHCR. And I mean, I think that the hugeness of this situation requires that all countries be on deck with a humanitarian response. But the fact is that this isn't being treated through a humanitarian frame. It's being treated through a security lens right now. And so, you know, people here in the U.S. in particular and elsewhere express a lot of concern about the impact of ISIS on the people of Syria, but then they paint Muslim Syrians fleeing from this horrific violence as national security threats rather than as human beings who are seeking refuge, freedom, and flourishing here in the U.S. and elsewhere. And the countries that are surrounding Syria have absorbed a huge number of Syrian refugees. I've been in Lebanon 3 times in the past few years. Most recently, I was there for a few weeks in July, and it's now estimated that over a quarter of Lebanon's population is Syrian refugees. And so this crisis is causing ripple effects in all of the countries surrounding it. But the problem is that this sort of prejudice and bigotry that we're seeing around the globe directed against Muslims is making it really challenging for other countries around the globe to be on deck in playing their part in responding to this humanitarian crisis. Yeah.
It's ironic, Catherine, that the Czech Republic in particular is making this argument since it is famous as one of the most secular societies in all of Europe. What are the ethical aspects of this that most concern you?
Well, you know, here in the U.S., Shoulder to Shoulder works with a number of faith-based partners who also have part of their work focusing on refugee resettlement and support. And they do this as part of their calling as people of faith to welcome the stranger, to help those in need. And I think that they're not able to do this as fully as they want to right now because of these sort of blockades of bringing Syrian refugees into the U.S. context, and we're seeing the same thing, as you mentioned, in Europe as well. And so it seems to me that what's really happening here is that people who want to live out their faith by welcoming strangers and helping those in need are actually being sort of prevented from doing so because of this bigotry and prejudice that is sort of disguised as national security sorts of concerns.
Security is one of those words that you can mention it and then you can get away with a whole lot of stuff that wasn't true.
Exactly. And I think you always have to ask, you know, security for whom? Because we're not talking about human security for the Syrians who are fleeing a situation of dire insecurity that most of us have never experienced, but the focus is more on national security for countries, particularly in the U.S. and Europe. And so when we talk about security, I think that, yeah, that term is thrown around and sort of clouds a lot of moral issues, but we always need to step back and ask, whose security is it that we're concerned about?
That's a really good point. Anti-refugee sentiment has been on the rise across Europe, even as record numbers of the victims of war and are expected to make their way to places like Germany this year. Who do you see doing successful work in the field of resettlement in this part of the world?
A huge number of them are faith-based organizations that work on refugee resettlement. We, you know, work with one organization in particular that we have partnered with on some of these issues here in the U.S. is HIAS, the Hebrew Immigration Aid Society, which was originally founded to help Jews escaping pogroms in Russia. And since then, they've been welcoming strangers from around the world, and they do a lot of really amazing work in Europe and in the U.S., helping those in need without having any sort of consideration of what, you know, community they're coming from. It doesn't matter. They're people in need, and they are there to help them. So that's one organization I would mention that's doing such great work. But there's so many other faith-based organizations and those that aren't faith-based doing refugee resettlement work in Europe and the U.S., but their ability to do their work is contingent upon the sort of political will in these countries in the U.S. and Europe to allow more refugees into the country. They can't do their work unless there are the refugees here to actually help.
Catherine, on this particular issue, the refugee issue, what's it like when you have a meeting of religions based in the United States talking about this subject?
You know, I think that there's a lot of common ground among the religious communities and religious leaders that I work with, that this is a crisis that as people of faith, we have to play a role in. We will look back at this crisis and just really regret, I think, not having made more effort to help the Syrians in need. And so I think that that's been the one encouraging thing, is that we have seen a lot of unity among the religious community in the United States around helping Syrian refugees. Mm-hmm. Now, to get the folks on the House Subcommittee on Homeland Security to see it that way is our challenge.
Yeah. The wars and the violence in foreign countries impacts refugees in a way that we see them coming to the United States. As politicians demonize undocumented immigrants, how does that kind of xenophobia spill over into our treatment of refugee issues in the House, in the Senate?
Well, I think it spills over a lot. It's, you know, a lot of the same voices actually who are saying very negative things about undocumented immigrants are also the same people who are saying negative things about refugees and about Muslims more generally. And you know, this comes back to the way in which American Muslims who are not refugees have been treated also in the public rhetoric for the last decade. Anti-Muslim rhetoric and sentiment has been rising in the United States. And so we see this sort of overlap happening between the anti-immigrant folks, the anti-refugee folks, and the anti-Muslim folks, and they're actually sort of teaming up in many ways, in, you know, in very specific ways too, through joint conferences and borrowing one another's talking points to create this culture of fear and this climate of fear of somebody who has been painted as an other, and painted it as an other in a way that distances them so much from you that it's hard to relate to them and to see them as a human and to act out of your humanity towards them.
In the meetings that you're attending and the conversations that you are overhearing, are there some solutions that are being considered as most promising?
The U.S. has historically been able to take in more refugees based on sort of the political will of the people in power and also of their constituents. So when there is political will here to let more folks into the U.S., then it happens. And there are a lot of organizations and communities that are committed to making an impact, a positive impact on this humanitarian crisis, and are working to better inform and lobby their politicians to see this as a humanitarian issue and not to constantly flip it into the national security frame. I think there's a lot of coalition building going on, a lot of people who are talking to one another and working together on this issue. And so that sort of solidarity, I think, is one place that there's hope, because we know that it's politically possible. It's completely possible to allow more refugees into this country. But I think, we have to do a lot of work to create that political will to move it that direction.
Interfaith Alliance is a member of the Shoulder to Shoulder campaign. Would you talk briefly about who some of the other members of the group are and the priorities for the campaign going forward?
Sure. So, yes, we are so grateful to have Interfaith Alliance as one of our members. We have 31 different religious denominations and organizations that are members of Shoulder to Shoulder. So we have the Union for Reform Judaism represented through the Religious Action Center. We have the Islamic Society of North America. We have the Presbyterian Church, the Methodists, the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, Sojourners, an evangelical organization. We have a number of different denominations and organizations that really represent a pretty broad spectrum of Americans who affiliate with these different traditions. Mm-hmm. And, they came together, as back in 2010 to say in a loud voice that anti-Muslim rhetoric and bigotry is a problem for us all. And so it's a problem we're going to all be working together to fight against, to end anti-Muslim bigotry in the U.S. We work both at the national level through these member organizations, helping to make sure that their voices are heard in the public square, saying that this is not okay, this is not a representation of what it means to be a person of faith, and it's not a good representation of America either. It betrays both religious and American values to have such negative rhetoric against Muslims. So we work on the national level in that way, and we speak into the media, we speak into political situations and meet with different folks from the White House and Department of Justice. And so we work at that sort of level, but we also work on the community level. We have 44 different community member organizations throughout the U.S. who are working on this issue in some way, shape, or form. And so we work to provide a platform to network them to one another, to be able to share experiences, to share skills, to invite one another to be part of initiatives. And then we work with them and with clergy members locally to help provide rapid responses when there are crises that happen. And I think one of the really encouraging things we've seen is that sometimes we're not needed to provide those rapid responses because the communities have organized themselves so well that there's already rapid responses going on when a Muslim community is targeted or something in a particular space.
I can almost assure you that there are listeners right now saying to themselves, we'd like to know more about the Shoulder to Shoulder campaign, and I know you can answer the question of how can they do that.
The easiest way is to visit our website, which is www.shouldertoshouldercampaign.org. And there you can sign up to keep updated through our newsletter, and you can also contact me, the campaign director. My email is listed on the website under the contact page. And so I'd encourage people to reach out to me directly if you'd like to connect with us and you'd like some direction on what that might look like for you and your community.
Catherine Osborne is director of the Shoulder to Shoulder campaign, doing vitally important work to counter the all too prevalent anti-Muslim sentiment in the U.S. and abroad. Catherine, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Reverend Gaddy. It was wonderful to be with you.
Alabama, Texas, Oklahoma, to name just a few. What do they have in common? Well, for one, a sectarian monument to the Ten Commandments prominently displayed on government property. And don't buy the empty argument that these monuments somehow represent the universal values this nation was founded on, etc., etc., blah, blah, blah. Just look at the first commandment from the perspective of anyone who doesn't revere the Christian or Jewish deity. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. And some of the monuments even add additional overtly Christian language to the biblical language. While there have been lawsuits calling for the removal of these unconstitutional displays and governments who have defied court orders to do so, there have also been attempts to at least add diversity to the displays, including those from atheists, Satanists, and in several states, American Hindus. Here to explore that last phenomenon is Suhag Shukla, co-founder and executive director of the Hindu American Foundation. Suhag, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So this issue has come up in at least two states that I'm aware of, first Oklahoma and now Arkansas. Is there a particular aspect of Hindu tradition that helps prompt this?
I don't think so. I think it's maybe trying to keep up with the Joneses at some level, but also maybe wanting to have the same acknowledgement that maybe Hindus feel that Christians and Jews and those from the Judeo-Christian communities get when they see public displays of the Ten Commandments.
I'd like to get your perspective on what it does to a community when there is overt endorsement of one religion over others like this.
Well, we've provided an overview of this back in 2005. But when the U.S. Supreme Court was hearing arguments for Van Orden versus Perry, a case dealing with the public display of the Ten Commandments on Texas state capitol grounds, we really elaborated on, one, not only the church-state arguments that are involved in these sorts of cases, but also specifically the theological differences that come up in terms of Hindu understandings of the nature of God, of the relationship between man and God, and how the Ten Commandments differ from not only Hindu tradition, but also Buddhist and Jain and other Dharmic traditions, and what that might make a Hindu feel like, more so an outsider than someone who's on the inside of the government's good grace.
In Arkansas, the legislature just mandated a Ten Commandments monument earlier this year, but the governor said no to a Hindu monument. Do you know the grounds that the governor used to make that decision?
So from the sources that have come across my desk, it sounds like it's more of a technicality than it is an overt rejection. Now, during the same time period, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, also submitted, I believe, a proposal for a display, and that was rejected by the Secretary of State's office. But in this particular case, from what I've read and what I understand, it was that the proposal was not made to the right party. I guess in Arkansas, you have to apply either through the General Assembly or the Arkansas State Capitol Arts and Grounds Commission. So I'm not quite sure what would happen to such an application if it went through those two bodies, because it's still going to have to stand up to constitutional muster.
I'm fascinated and really pleased by the interreligious coalition that is endorsing the Hindu monument in Arkansas. The proposal by the Universal Society of Hinduism has gained the support of Christian, Jewish, and other faith leaders. Regardless of the outcome, talk about the significance of this kind of mutual support.
I think it's beautiful. I think this is what America represents. This is what our founding fathers envisioned in terms of people of different faiths being able to practice their faith privately, but also come together on their shared values. And that's what is so important about the separation of church and state, so that the government isn't playing favorites with any particular group. That said, as beautiful as it is for people of faith to come together, I think that when we talk about public displays, it opens up a can of worms. You know, when are we going to stop? How many displays do you put up? And I think those are important questions to ask. You know, in all fairness, if the Ten Commandments are going to be up there, and certainly the Supreme Court had said that as long as the purpose is not religious alone, but there's some historical context or some other sort of significance, then that they've allowed those sorts of displays, I'm sure that, you know, you can find a secular purpose for any religious display, but then there needs to be a fairness where all communities are represented, and that's where it becomes a difficult and logistical issue, I think, for government.
What role does Hanuman play in Hindu tradition?
So Hanuman is a deity who is kind of a central character in one of the great epics of Hinduism called the Ramayana. And he's symbolic. He's a hero in this Hindu lore, and there's so many lessons that Hindus draw from Hanuman. He is a symbol of strength. He's also a symbol of pure devotion. He ends up being the only figure in the Ramayana who really is perfect. Even Lord Rama, who is considered an avatar or a manifestation of Vishnu, makes some mistakes as he has manifested as man. But Hanuman and his pure devotion to Lord Rama is something that from a very young age, children are taught to emulate. I know that with our two boys, from when a young age, we would say, oh, you have to be strong like Hanuman. You have to be devoted like Hanuman. So he's really a beloved character in Hindu society as well as Hindu lore.
As the third largest religion in the world, Hinduism is certainly underrepresented in the United States, but there are 3 million followers in this country, so it's foolish for some to try to dismiss the matter. What are the consequences, as you see them, of favoring one faith tradition over others? You've already touched on that, but I'd like to reiterate it because of its importance.
I mean, it can cut both ways. Religion should be a force for good and a force that brings people together. And I think that the rallying support that this Hindu organization has received from various faith groups is emblematic of that. But at the same time, it can be divisive for a variety of reasons. People may be unfamiliar with Hindu tenets, or maybe there's another religious tradition that comes around the corner. I think it's in Oklahoma where it's the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. Do we want the government to be in a position to decide which religions are, you know, valid enough to pass whatever requirements they have in order to allow a public display? I think that those are very important questions that we need to be asking ourselves. And on just a practical matter, for me personally, if I knew there was a Hanuman statue at any public place, I would want to know that it's not going to be open to being desecrated. I think that people who want to put up Ten Commandments should be thinking about the same thing. Do you want someone spitting on it? Do you want someone urinating on it? I mean, anything can happen in a public space. Someone might throw beer cans at it or put graffiti, and these are the types of things that I think we open up our religious symbols to, those dangers, when we're trying to push public displays in public or areas that are not necessarily going to be protected and considered sacred in the same way that they might on a religious body's property or a church's property.
So, Suhag, ultimately, would you rather see inclusion and diversity or adherence to the constitutional prohibition on favoring one religion over others in matters like these monuments?
That's a tough one. That's asking me if I like chocolate or vanilla, and I like both. You know, on a practical matter, to err is to be human, and our government is made up of people. So to err on the side of caution and to ensure that all religious traditions are respected, I think the more practical way is to just not put up religious displays. In an idealistic sense, if we ever get to a point where all religions are respected and valued, and we can live in a society where we mutually respect one another for one another's beliefs, and also accept you know, at some level that someone else might be on their own true path and my path is not the only way. If we ever get to that, it'd be wonderful to see displays of all, you know, religions standing side by side. But those issues, again, are wrought with problems and with very practical logistical issues.
You know, I can't do this interview without saying how proud I am and how grateful I am to the Hindu American Foundation for honoring me with the Mahatma Gandhi Award. It means a lot to me. The truth is, I'm not biased because of that. I was already very appreciative of the work done by the Hindu American Foundation. Tell us some of your most important current initiatives.
One of the issues that the Hindu community, not just in the United States, but globally face, is the presentation of Hinduism in the academy and as an extension in K through 12 education. Some of the earliest studies of Hinduism were done in the British colonial era. So clearly there were some political and even missionary viewpoints that were coming into the way that Hinduism has been portrayed. So it's not always in not only a positive light, but an accurate light. And so we're trying to right the balance of that. And we've been working with scholar practitioners, with religious figures, as well as educators in creating a Hinduism 101 in which we are training public school teachers on how to teach about Hinduism when they cover their units on world religion or ancient Indian history. So that's a project that's really near and dear to my heart, having gone through the U.S. public education system and being teased relentlessly after those units in which Hinduism was really caricaturized and stereotyped. It's really something that's close to my heart and something that I'm really proud of. The other issue is our human rights work, really focusing and trying to give voice to Hindus, not in the United States, but around the globe in countries like Pakistan and Bangladesh, who really are not able to enjoy the freedoms that we're able to as Hindus in the United States, to freely practice, to freely believe, and to be who we are. And trying to give voice to those communities and bringing awareness to our elected leadership so that when the United States is engaging with those countries, that human rights and religious freedom remain at the forefront alongside with trade and security talks.
Suhail, you know me well enough to know that this next question was coming. We have a former Hindu running for the President of the United States nomination in the Republican Party. My curiosity is, because there is a Hindu on the ballot in the primaries, what are Hindus doing? How are they handling that? Is there a so close an affinity of seeing we have a Hindu possibly in the White House, or are you not paying attention to the religion involved and looking at the merits of that person serving the country?
Well, certainly, I think it means a lot to know that the United States has broken through, at least for the highest office, the race ceiling. Mm-hmm. With the election of President Obama, 2 terms, and, you know, if now an Asian candidate or an Indian American candidate were to be able to hold that office, it certainly is symbolic in that sense. But I still firmly believe that there's a religious litmus test, spoken or unspoken, when it comes to some of these higher offices. And with this particular candidate who renounced Hinduism, I think in his younger days, I think that I think it takes our community many steps backwards mm-hmm. because it's not just a matter of finding another path, because certainly Hinduism is a pluralistic tradition that really emphasizes freedom at the individual level to find your way to have a relationship with God. But it's the rebuke of the former tradition, I think, that's hurtful, mm-hmm. to deny any association or even warm feelings towards it. When this candidate was in the Congress and there was a resolution that was recognizing the significance of Diwali to the Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain communities and the Sikh communities as a holiday of significance, he abstained. Now, even if you no longer are part of a particular religious community, certainly you're culturally still connected to them in some way or another, or your parents are, or many of your constituents are. So it's, I think, the outright rejection that we oftentimes see in the rhetoric that comes out that is discouraging and really kind of promotes this idea that in order to succeed, assimilation is more important than integration, and that there is one particular, model that you have to be Christian, even if you're a different skin color or from a different nationality, that somehow that Christianity makes you a little bit more American, that I think is a discouraging message. Hmm.
That's very well said. So I need for this answer, your answer, to be shorter than my question.
Okay.
What is the website of the Hindu American Foundation?
It is www.hafsite.org.
Suhag Shukla is the co-founder and executive director of the Hindu American Foundation, an advocacy organization for the Hindu American community that does great work both here and around the world. She is a good friend. Suhag, I really appreciate you being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a very sincere thank you. We appreciate your support. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. Look, if you find value in what you're hearing, and if you think it's important that more people hear what you're hearing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We really need you to help bring them into this family so that the discussion is broad and numerous perspectives are represented. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.